It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about the new documentary that follows a Madison man who tries to reduce his medication for a mental illness. We talk with the director of the film, Crazy. First, a new package of bills aimed at reducing homelessness in Wisconsin was introduced by state Republican lawmakers yesterday. In the legislation, lawmakers are calling for a new council to be created and for state money to be allocated for grant programs, among other things. Laurel White joins us now. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Laurel, who's proposing this suite of bills?
So it's a small coalition of Republican lawmakers. On the Assembly side, kind of leading the charge is Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinecke. And then on the Senate side, it's Alberta Darling, who is one of the chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, so a prominent Republican in the Senate. So we've got two powerful players in both the Assembly and Senate backing this package of bills.
And like you said, it's a package of bills. Can you break that down a little for us? What's in them?
Sure. So we have four bills here. And one of them, as you mentioned, is creating a council that brings together different state agencies that provide services to the homeless. So it kind of identifies the primary providers for homeless services, picks out about eight agencies, and has the secretary of each of those agencies sit on this council. They're supposed to come together and talk about services, kind of coordinate, review state policy, and possibly establish some new state policies. And interestingly, Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish has stepped up and said that she's interested in chairing this new council if the legislation does pass.
And that's another, I gather, looks at the funding allocations for housing. How does that work?
That's right. So this is one of the reforms to different grant programs for combating homelessness in Wisconsin. It's a little bit wonky. Essentially, Wisconsin had allocated money for housing solutions for the homeless and specified what sort of housing that money needed to be spent on. And there have been new models that have emerged for service providers. Some folks might be familiar with models called Housing First or Rapid Rehousing. So these are kind of developing models in the homeless services community. And what this legislation would do would be to allow state funding to flow more readily into those types of housing solutions rather than pre-identified, previous models. So it's not any new money. It's about $300,000 that this legislation deals with, but that's previously allocated money. It's not any spending increase. It's just kind of a rearranging.
And what about funding for homeless shelters?
So one of the other things that isn't specifically to do with shelters, there's nothing in this package actually that has to do with shelters. But another thing that this legislation would do is to start a new two-year pilot program that helps people who have been in and out of shelters frequently. They're called chronically homeless. So the National Housing and Urban Development Department defines chronically homeless as someone who has some sort of disabling condition, whether that's mental health, physical disability, who's been homeless for a year or more, or who has reentered homelessness at least four times in the past 3 years. So this new pilot program would target those individuals and actually push them up a waiting list to get them Section 8 housing. So they wouldn't be utilizing shelters. They wouldn't be continuing to kind of re-enter the system as they had been in previous years. And according to some numbers that lawmakers shared yesterday, it sounds like there are about 5,000 people that fit this this classification on the waiting list. Now, not all of those folks are chronically homeless, but the waiting list is about 5,000. It would move the chronically homeless to the top of that list.
We're talking with Laurel White right now, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, and she's with us to talk about a new package of GOP bills just announced, introduced in the state legislature that aims to address homelessness in the state. And Laurel, looking again at that Section 8 housing, I understand that availability has been a problem. There's been a shortage. Has anything been done to address that particular aspect?
No. That is a question that came up at the press conference yesterday. This package of bills doesn't do anything to increase the amount of affordable housing in Wisconsin, doesn't add any money, to create new facilities or anything like that. This is a lot of sort of structural rearranging. Kind of, I talked about moving around the money a little bit, launching the pilot program to target certain populations. So it wouldn't aim to get more people in housing by creating more housing. It's just trying to be, I think, what proponents would say would be more strategic about how services are provided and hopefully, I think in their eyes, making services more efficient, effective, reaching the people that need it most.
And is there anything within this package, Laurel, that looks at employment or job training specifically?
There is a program. They're calling it the Better Way Initiative. This is kind of an interesting program that they say is modeled off of something that has been happening in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The program is called Better Way there, and it's a van that drives around, picks up homeless people, and offers them employment, pays them to do kind of cleanup or other work on public places. So this piece of legislation that's actually also included in the governor's budget, three of these four bills are in the governor's budget, would launch this program in Wisconsin. And it would provide $75,000 in each year of the biennium, so $150,000 total, to local municipalities that are interested in having this sort of Better Way model in their community. Now, there is a financial caveat. Municipalities have to come up with $50,000 of their own to match the $75,000 coming from the state. So this is something that, you know, wouldn't necessarily be implemented immediately with state funds. It requires that state and local collaboration to actually get on its feet and get running.
And I know that this idea that homelessness is an urban problem, that idea has been talked about lawmakers and saying this is a myth we need to dispense with and treat this as something that affects urban and rural areas. Do you see that sort of holistic approach when you look at this particular suite of bills?
Absolutely. That's something that Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinecke mentioned yesterday that was top of mind for Republican lawmakers as they were discussing this package of bills. And if you remember back when we talked a little bit about that reallocation of funding for those different housing models, well, another little facet of that particular bill is actually freeing up money to move more freely around the state. Currently, funding is required kind of geographically, but now if this legislation passes, it could move more readily to high needs areas. We don't know exactly what that would mean, but, you know, in terms of where the money would go, we don't know right now what the most high needs areas are for sure. It's not listed in the legislation, but that kind of changes how the funding is spread out across the state potentially.
And as we wrap up, you know, we've been saying this is a GOP package of bills. What have Democrats had to say about it?
Well, Democrats weren't incredibly thrilled by the package released yesterday. We had some statements coming out after the bills were released. Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca said that the bills don't go far enough. Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling said, you know, she actually sort of pivoted and said, this is what Democrats don't want to do. Democrats want to raise wages. They want to expand access to affordable health care. And we want to work on restoring tenant rights. So she sort of dismissed the Republicans' plans and said, this is what we would rather work on. And then we had a couple Madison lawmakers step up and say, you know, these are cosmetic, not real solutions. The cosmetic term was from Melissa Sargent, a Madison Democrat, and then Madison Democrat Lisa Subek said, people with no place to sleep tonight, this is a quote, don't have time to wait for a bureaucratic council or pilot program. So we had some pretty quick pushback from Democrats in the legislature against this package.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, and she was with us there to talk about a suite of GOP bills just introduced in the legislature that aims to address homelessness here in Wisconsin. The documentary film Crazy explores a conflict over who has the right to decide how to medicate a person diagnosed with schizophrenia. The documentary centers around a man named Eric in Madison who wants to change his medication because he says it's causing him side effects.
The police handcuffed him to a chair and got him to take 2 milligrams of risperidone.
If coercion is necessary to get him back to that point of stability, then that's what's necessary.
Eric is too sick to be able to decide whether the medication will help him or not. In most mental commitment cases, that's the end of it.
Lisa Zumwalt joins us now. She produced and directed the documentary Crazy. It's her first feature project. She's worked on films for National Geographic Television, PBS, BBC, and the History Channel. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your film brings out the tensions between the rights of society and the rights of an individual when it comes to mental health care. Can you tell us about the man at the center of this tension? His name is Eric, and he's from here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Right. Eric is when I met him in 2011, was 27, super bright, genetics major, very shy, very personable, very honest, and very principled.
And the tension comes out in that Eric does not agree that it's in his best interest to take the dosage of medication that he's being prescribed, and his father is a physician, wants to get involved as well, but they run into a conflict with Dane County. Can you tell us about that conflict and who's at the various sides of this battle?
Right. So Eric was diagnosed when he was 19, diagnosed schizophrenic, and he was, took on traditional treatment, which is basically antipsychotic medication, and he was compliant for about 8 years. In 2011, he became frightened that he was suffering a common side effect of antipsychotic meds, which is tardive dyskinesia. It's a nervous system disorder, and it can be damaging, and it can be permanent. He was on a low dose, and he decided to go off his meds. Sometime later, he was found on a second-floor balcony and talking to himself, and police decided that he was a danger to himself, and doctors agreed, and he was placed under involuntary commitment in Dane County, which means that he's going to be treated with antipsychotic medications, whether he wants to be treated or not. And he was put on an extremely high dose. I think his father said something like 10 times the dose that he had been on, and he didn't like it. And so that began a battle between him and the county over what medications he would take and how much he would take. And that battle went on for some time. And that's really what the film is about.
And this is not just Eric and his father. There's also a legal aspect. There was an attorney involved. Can you tell us about some of the core issues that your film tracks as this got mediated over the course of time?
Right. So Eric's decision to go off medications or to go on a low dose, even though he was court-ordered to take medications, thrust him into a series of conflicts, and one of them was legal. Eric was probably very lucky in that he had a family member who was able to afford to fight some of these issues out in court. Generally, those things don't happen. But Eric had signed an advance directive which said that, if he was considered mentally unfit or unstable, that these are the wishes of how he would want to be treated. And those wishes were not being addressed. And so Eric and his dad went to court to try to get those wishes enforced. And that's a scene that we see in the film in which the judge explains to him that because he's under a commitment order, the commitment order trumps any wishes that he may have. That's significant because in our country, anyone and everyone gets to make their own medical decisions. particularly if they have an advance directive. But it falls into a gray area in some places with advance directives. So that was one area of conflict that we see.
So when the court orders Eric to take that medication, is that order meant to be in perpetuity or how long? What's the statute of limitations there?
Well, you know, it's a little bit up to the judge and the psychiatrist. You know, generally, I think these things go in something like 3 month cycles. But Eric ended up being under commitment until actually for a period of years. What's interesting is that a judge can decide that somebody will be medicated whether they want to be treated or not.
And when someone is diagnosed, as Eric was, to be a danger to themselves, what freedoms does that person have to give up along the way?
Right. Well, they're going to give up some of their constitutional rights. I mean, we're talking about the right to determine where you live, the right to determine what's going into your body, you know, what medication you're taking, what treatment you're getting. These are located in, but they're basic constitutional rights.
We're talking right now with Lisa Zumwalt, producer and director of the new documentary film Crazy, talking about a young man named Eric with schizophrenia who had wanted to control his medication, came into conflict with the courts who said he had to take his medication. And going forward from that point, and looking at some of these tangles about, you know, where Eric's rights end, where societies begin or the courts begin, there has been this prevailing narrative that if people with mental illness do the right thing, that is to take their prescribed medications, that everything will be okay. And in this sense, looking at it from that sense, how did Eric's case shed light on that kind of cultural narrative that we have?
You know, it's so complicated. I wish I could just tease it all out for you quickly. I can't, and that's why I made a film. But I think that some of the things I learned while making the film was that, you know, I also believed when I started the film that if people just took their meds, they'd be safe and so would we. And some of the things I learned is that meds work for some people, but they don't work for everyone. They're not a one-size-fits-all solution. And in fact, it's something like 3/4 of people who are on antipsychotic medications will stop taking them within 18 months, mostly because they can't tolerate the side effects. So the drugs work really well for some people, but they don't work for everybody, and I think that's important. Another thing that I thought was that mental illness was, you know, pervasive. It's not. It's mostly episodic. I didn't understand that people that were diagnosed had tremendous self-awareness. I think that's important. And I think another thing to think about is, you know, we need to talk about forced treatment. You know, does it work? You know, is it necessary? Because it take away someone's fundamental control and choice is basically disempowering. And the question is, does it work on a practical level? But also, is that a good idea?
When you talk about that element of self-awareness, there are psychiatrists out there who say that when you are someone who is suffering from mental illness, that you might not have the judgment to know whether you should be off your medication. You might not be the right person to make that call. How did that end up playing out in this particular story of Eric?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a very gray area. You'll hear that argument made a lot, and it was made in Eric's case that, you know, he wasn't on his medication, so therefore he couldn't be making, quote-unquote, good decisions. And the flip side of that is that people who are on medication or who are diagnosed with severe mental illness have what they call lived experience, right? They know what it's like to be them. So, and I'm sure you'll also hear many family members that'll say, forget it, you know, they just need to be on their meds and that's all I want to know about it because they really don't know what they're talking about, you know. So it's a very conflicted area. But one of the things I learned is that people with severe mental illness have a lot more self-awareness than I thought they did. They have a lot more to say about mental illness and mental wellness than I had ever understood before. And I think it's well worth our time to check it out.
And you've had experience, obviously, working as a filmmaker in many other areas, but you were very close to the action this time, and something that was very emotionally fraught and had some very tangled issues involved. What was it like working on this film for you?
Well, I mean, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, it was just fantastic because the story was, you know, full of conflict, which is what you want for a good story. And yes, it's true. I respected Eric a lot. He's a very, very honest person. And I felt that he always told me the truth whenever it was happening. So I cared a lot about what happened to him. But Eric made mistakes, too. You know, everybody made mistakes. The county made mistakes. Eric made mistakes. It was just a tremendous story to work on. And it was very rewarding, I think, because ultimately, no matter what I wanted from the story, I felt that I had to serve the story and just tell the truth, of what was happening. And when you're working on a subject like this, that becomes a very good honor to have.
And you started working on this film back in 2012, so fast forward 5 years. And how is Eric doing today?
I'm happy to say Eric is doing absolutely great and has been for a while. He managed to come up with a solution with his doctors that worked for him and returned to a state of wellness that allowed him to graduate from college with a degree, get a job in a software company, work in a peer respite center, which is an alternative treatment center for people with severe mental illness. And last summer he got married. So I would say things are going just great.
And Lisa, before we let you go, can you tell us when your documentary might be released to a wider audience?
We're working on that now to see what film, you know, where we're going to be premiering and which film festivals. And we're talking to some distributors, but I believe we'll be releasing in February of this year.
Lisa, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Zumwalt is producer and director of the new documentary film Crazy, which features a story based here in Wisconsin, in Madison. She's been a writer, producer, and editor on National Geographic and the History Channel. Agriculture is a major part of Wisconsin's history. It's also one of the biggest economic drivers in the state, contributing more than $88 billion annually to the state's economy. But this tradition could be in jeopardy. Wisconsin's current farmers are aging out of the profession. But for young people who want to become farmers, there are a number of hurdles they need to clear, like accessing capital, learning how to care for crops, animals, and land. Dori Eder joins us now to talk about the challenges facing farmers when they're just starting out. She's the Farm Beginnings Organizer for the Land Stewardship Project, which is a nonprofit group which advocates for farmers and provides educational opportunities for early career farmers in western Wisconsin and eastern Minnesota. Dori, also a farmer herself. Dori, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so first, you farm in addition to all this other work that you do. Why did you want to pursue farming?
Well, I didn't grow up with any background in farming, and that makes me kind of typical of the beginning farmers that we serve. But I was a mid-career transition to farming, and I spent 20 years in a career in public service, and then what I really wanted was a career that had a direct relationship to the land and was more integrated with my family. And those are the reasons that a lot of beginning farmers are interested in careers in farming.
And was it easy for you to make that transition? What was it like during the early years farming?
Well, it certainly wasn't. So,
you're laughing so much now.
We were able to, my husband and I both continue to work full-time off of the farm, and that's how we were able to afford a second mortgage to purchase our small acreage where we farm now while we kept working. And so we tried to get our farm up and running kind of part-time and on the weekends, and I was eventually able, the reason I'm able to farm is because my husband still works off-farm, and that provides a stable source of income for our family. And then I transitioned my work to working with beginning farmers at Land Stewardship Project, which gave me more time to focus on building our farm enterprise. But because I work full-time, I also don't have a lot of extra time to grow the farm. So it's profitable, but it certainly doesn't meet all of our income needs.
And so you've had this experience yourself going through it and working with the farm and trying to grow those challenges. What are some of the challenges you hear from the farmers you worked with that they encounter when they first start off like you did?
Oh, sure. Well, the number one barrier that beginning farmers identify is access to land. And some of that is obviously related to access to mortgage and financing to purchase land. Farming is considered fairly high risk. There are programs through the USDA to help finance purchases of farmland, but only for people who have a certain amount of experience. So very beginning farmers often find themselves looking at trying to get huge mortgages without having the income or the credit to qualify for what they need, or they end up purchasing smaller acreage than they need to sustain a farm business, or sometimes marginal land or farmsteads that are need a lot of work, right? So they have to make big investments of time and money to get the farm into a condition to be able to be profitable.
And in your experience, are banks wary about lending to farmers?
For beginning farmers, I think that is an issue. I know for a lot of young people interested in farming, they have a high amount of debt, like college-related debt. So that always, for any mortgage, is going to be a red flag for lenders. I think being able to demonstrate to a banker that you're small farm plans are profitable and that you're going to be able to pay back that loan out of your farm profits is also a challenge, because there's so much capitalization that needs to happen to get up and running that often farms don't turn a profit for several years.
And in terms of startup costs, what you need besides the land, I imagine there's a lot of other resources you're going to need to stock and get ready to farm the land. What kinds of costs are involved there? What kind of equipment and that sort of thing will people need?
Sure. Well, it depends. It depends on what people are growing. You know, some of the, like a vegetable farm on a few rented acres could be very low input and affordable if people are able to do a lot of work by hand and not rely on machinery. So some of those costs could be really low, a low entry. If you're doing, you know, hundreds of acres of crop farming or something like dairy that requires $1 million worth of infrastructure, that's really a different ball game. So, I mean, it can really vary. There's so many kinds of farming and at such different scales and kind of types. Many beginning farmers who are not inheriting farms or have access to farm land started a small scale and worked their way up.
We're talking with Dori Eder right now. She's the Farm Beginnings Organizer for the Land Stewardship Project, and she's also a farmer herself. And she's with us to talk about the challenges that can face new farmers. And what about that, the knowledge of working the land itself, how to get the best yield, what practices work best for planting? How do new farmers pick up stuff like that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we run a farmer training program that is mostly focused on the business of running a farm business. But the origin of that program is that we had farmers involved with Land Stewardship Project who, after the farm crisis of the 80s, were really concerned that there would be nowhere for new farmers to learn what had been lost by the generational loss of farms. And so that's why we started the program. Most of what people need to learn in terms of production is best learned through a mentor farmer, working with an experienced farmer. And we help connect people to those kind of mentors. There are other organizations that do that too. But for most people, working on a farm and having a farm mentor are the best education they could get in terms of production.
I think of farming in a way, and this could be completely wrong, but as a solitary endeavor sort of within the family where it gets passed down that way, but that there may not be big groups of farmers that get together to share knowledge. Is there that kind of way to exchange knowledge for farmers?
Mm-hmm. it's especially important for people who don't have that family history of farming or don't have a multi-generational farmers to rely on. So, you know, we view part of our role as we train farmers is to connect them with each other as a network of support. And it's hugely important. You know, farming is can be isolating. It can be frustrating. You're also at the mercy of the weather and global markets and things that you can't control. So having a solid support system of other farmers is crucial to getting people through the rough patches in their farming career.
Now, you mentioned you yourself you worked your way up. You have another job alongside farming, as does your husband. Is that common for new farmers that they don't just take the plunge and they're a full-time farmer, but they have to sort of ramp up?
Yeah, that's generally, it's generally wise, and it's what we generally advise people to do, is to start off slowly, mitigate their risks. You know, if you're going to do a big capital investment, you don't want to run the risk of ruining your finances or your credit. So start off slow, scale up slowly over time, have a farm income to rely on. The USDA had a statistic from the last farm census that 85% of farms have off-farm income. And that's not just beginners, that's everybody. So it is very common for people to do other work in addition to farming. Some of that's seasonal and some of it's full-time, where one, you know, partner has an off-farm job that also comes with health insurance and other benefits, while the other partner farms full-time.
It seems like I've also been seeing more farms who are using the farm as a tourist destination, too. Maybe in the spring they do sort of lambing activities, or there's a pumpkin patch in the fall. Are there starting to be new ways to bring more income in, thinking of the farm more as a destination?
Yes, and farms, you know, need to be thinking about diverse streams of income in order to protect themselves from crop failures and other kinds of risks. So agritourism is one income stream that people are really interested in. I know a lot of people who start farming too do it because they want to share the kind of education about food production with the broader community. So I see a lot of people want to build that into their farm planning to get people onto their farms. And then we also have things like taco nights and pizza farms and ways to get people onto farm experiencing the activities of the farm, and also generating some revenue for the farmer.
We're talking with Dori Eder right now. She's the Farm Beginnings Organizer for the Land Stewardship Project, and she's a farmer herself, joining us now to talk about the challenges facing new farmers. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how to start a farm? Or if you're a farmer, what advice would you give to someone who is just beginning? If you've made it through those first 5 years, what was most crucial to know? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the challenges facing novice farmers with Dori Eder. She's the Farm Beginnings Organizer for the Land Stewardship Project. And we'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have about the first steps to become a farmer? If you're a farmer now, what challenges did you face along the way, and what advice do you have? And what do you think would have helped you the most as you went through that journey? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We have Larry joining us first in Kenosha. Larry, hi.
Hi there. I admire people that do farming today. I am surprised that they can make a living at it. I'm almost in my 70s. I was raised on a farm. I would never go back to farming. You couldn't do it today with the BNR regulations. What we had back then would not fly today. We had grade B milk. I don't even think anybody's got grade B milk anymore. Everybody's got to be grade A, which is very, very costly. And I would just be surprised how anybody makes it today with the DNR regulations on farming.
All right, Larry, thank you for that. Larry, say you never go back to farming, Dori, and he sees too many regulations. Is that something you hear from young farmers, that there are hindrances, maybe like regulations, that make it too hard to make a go of it?
There are. I mean, there are some barriers to farming, especially for small-scale farmers who don't really get to take advantage of the economies of scale in a commodity marketplace. So it does require a lot of creativity, creating new markets. You know, the CSA movement was started by farmers who were trying to find a new way to become profitable. So it does require this kind of creative thinking about diversification and where you enter the markets, and a lot more direct sales so that farmers are capturing more of the retail dollar for their products. And I know a lot of young farmers, too, who grew up on farms and whose folks, you know, didn't want them to go into farming because it was a really hard life and it was a struggle. But they hope to be able to do it differently and maybe on a different scale. But it's not stopping people from still wanting to farm. It's a pretty deep, deeply felt calling for the folks who want to do it.
Well, thank you for that call. And we're going to move next to Owen in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, this is a subject that we definitely need to do more research on, and I appreciate you guys bringing this up today. My question is, well, my first question, I don't have the internet, but I'm on a farm. I work as an employee, and my typical day starts at 3:30 and ends anywhere between 5 and 8 o'clock at night.
Wow.
That's how much energy I put into farming for somebody else. I collect a salary. And what I'm trying to do is find a way to buy my own farm. But I talked to the FSA a few years ago. My credit score is 680. But they're not interested in lending somebody like me money that doesn't have a lot of other type of assets that can be used as collateral.
Mm.
And I was wondering how to get in touch with you folks, and maybe you folks could help me and my partner try to get some help learning about how we can get creative with financing or potentially some sort of program that wants to continue to work a smaller parcel of land instead of a larger corporate type of farm buying that land, because that's what's happening all around here.
Owen, thank you so much. And getting at some of those barriers to capital in the beginning, those startup to buy land, that kind of money. What advice do you have for him, Dory?
This is a kind of a consistent or persistent problem across the board. Though I can tell you that there have been inroads made in the farm financing arena, especially where it concerns small farms and specialty crop farmers. So, you know, what we hear a lot from FSA is they want to make sure that the folks approaching them for loans have some kind of education in the business aspects of running a farm. Sometimes all it takes is a community college course. Our course, the Farm Beginnings class, satisfies those requirements. And then we're kind of there to be advocates, too, and kind of help people through the process of working with FSA and getting clear about what their requirements are, and not just kind of their, if they're having a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the scale or the size of someone's prospective operation, we want to make sure that the farmer has all the details and information they need to make a case to FSA that their farm plan is profitable.
And Dory, do you want to give some contact information for Owen and for anybody else who's listening who wants to get a hold of you?
Sure. You can visit our website at landstewardshipproject.org. There is a tab there called More Farmers on the Land, and that's where you can find all the Farm Beginnings information. If you also go to beginningfarmers.org, you'll see all of our sister programs around the country, including other programs in Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest.
Terrific. Thank you for that, Dory. And Owen, good luck to you. And I'm glad you're listening today. Let's go next to Aaron joining us in Peshtigo. Aaron, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm a beginning farmer, new farmer, and I wanted to share kind of my experience in breaking into the field. I had an old family friend who had owned some farmland but didn't farm anymore, but I told them I had an interest in farming, and so we were able to work out a land contract where I didn't have to go through a bank to get a mortgage for financing. And so that's how I was able to purchase my farm at a reasonable rate. I didn't invest all my capital into land, and that enabled me to utilize my savings to purchase things that actually make money, being cattle and pigs. And instead of investing in huge equipment that costs a lot of money and depreciates, I decided to go with a pasture-based farming system, grass-fed beef, pastured pork. They require very little investment, just fencing and water systems. And so I don't have a lot of skin in the game, but I get a premium for my product.
Aaron, thank you for sharing that. Interesting. So he had a relationship with a retiring farmer and didn't have to buy the land outright, but had a deal with the farmer to, I guess, some sort of like it's sort of leasing the land. What about a solution like that? Is there a model for that, Dory?
Yep, there sure is. And there are lots of people who own farmlands that's not in production or is being rented out to neighbors, or retiring farmers who are really invested in seeing a beginning farmer get started on the land. At our website, landstewardshipproject.org, we also host a clearinghouse for people who have land available for rent or sale in the region and people who are looking. So while we can't kind of do individual matchmaking, we do provide that forum for folks who are looking. And then we also work with retiring farmers who want to transition to the next generation of farmers to find ways to do that meet everyone's needs, right? So most farm families feel like they have to sell their farm at top dollar because that's their whole retirement, right? They weren't able to necessarily save in an IRA or a, you know, employer-sponsored retirement account. But they also have a really vested interest in seeing someone continue to farm that land. And so we try to help people figure out how to do that and still retire comfortably.
We're talking with Dory Eater right now from the Farm Beginnings she's the Farm Beginnings organizer, I should say, for the Land Stewardship Project. It's an advocacy and educational organization. We're talking about challenges facing new farmers. And Dory, are there policies that you think, you know, maybe Wisconsin should be looking at to boost new farmer success rate?
Well, I think there are a lot of great ideas. I know something that has come up in Wisconsin and that the National Young Farmers Coalition is promoting is the student loan debt forgiveness for folks who go into farming. In Minnesota right now, we're trying to come up with a tax credit system for retiring farmers who want to sell or rent to beginning farmers. So there are things that can happen on the local level. And then, you know, every 10 years, we renegotiate a farm bill where we advocate for to beef up the programming for beginning farmers and their access to capital and some other kinds of reforms, as in like crop insurance and direct payment reforms that in some cases inflate the price of land and make it more difficult for people to access it.
And Dory, just a couple seconds left, but as we wrap up here, are we seeing signs that it's working, that there are young people starting to move into the field of farming?
We think so. So we've been running our Farm Beginnings program for 20 years, and we've graduated more than 800 people, 70% of whom are still involved in farming. So we don't necessarily see any enthusiasm for wanting to farm dropping off or waning anytime soon. But the barriers are significant, and it's going to take creative thinking both from the farmers and on the policy level and from the community of people who care about rural economies.
And we leave it there. Dory, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
That was Dory Eater, the Farm Beginnings organizer for the Land Stewardship Project, talking about the challenges facing new farmers. Remember when everyone was playing Pokemon Go last year? Some people are still at it. Those were happy times, according to new research out of UW-Madison. Researchers tracked things like mood and behavior for a few weeks on people who were playing the game and found that Pokemon Go players were more physically active. They walked more, and that part, not that surprising, but Pokemon Go players were also more positive. They were more friendly, and they reported experiencing more positive emotions. So in short, sounds like Pokemon Go players were happier. Sure, there was negative press about people falling down, walking into trees, but Pokemon Go seems to have helped people kind of crack the happiness code a little bit. So, with news like that, I say, go forth, my friends, and catch 'em all.